You're listening to TIP.
Hey everyone, welcome to this Wednesday's release of the Bitcoin Fundamentals Podcast. This episode is brought to you by River, the place that I personally go to securely invest in Bitcoin with confidence and with zero fees. Today's episode is a very special interview for me. For many people in the Bitcoin community, they're familiar with Alex Gladstein's work on explaining how the legacy fiat systems leverages the IMF and World Bank to bankrupt the developing nations all around the world so that developed economies like the United States can extract valuable natural resources from these various locations all around the world. Well, today's guest is none other than Mr. John Perkins, who's a noteworthy author and the author of these books called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. For people not familiar with John, he writes in gory detail all the ways that these strategies took place all around the world because he was an economic hitman actually executing these strategies on behalf of government entities. This interview was so mind-blowing and something that you've just got to share with anybody that's interested in understanding how this entire fiat scheme has been played for the past half century. During the interview, my good friend Nico Lechuga, who's a big fan of John's work, accompanied me on asking questions and part of the discussion. So without further delay, here's my chat with Mr. John Perkins.
Celebrating 10 years, you are listening to Bitcoin Fundamentals by the Investors Podcast Network. Now for your host, Preston Pysh.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. I'm here with John Perkins and Nico Lechuga. And John, I have to start off. I read a lot of books. This book has to be in my top books I've read in the past 5 years. And anybody who's listening to this show, I'm going to start off the show. You have to read this book because it's so profound, especially with everything that's happening in the world right now. For people that are not dialed in or haven't read your book, this is where I kind of want to start this conversation, John, is just what is an economic hitman? How did you become one? Really just kind of start with the basics for maybe somebody that's not familiar with your work.
Okay, Preston, first of all, I just want to make sure that there's a trilogy of the economic hitman book. I presume you're talking about the latest one, which deals with China's economic hitman.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Oh, that's the second in the edition.
Okay.
There's a third one that came out just this past year.
Nico has that covered.
There's the third one, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So an economic hitman, my official title was chief economist at a major international consulting firm. I had a staff of anywhere from 30 to 50 people working for me, depending on the specific time and projects. My job really was to identify countries that have resources that corporations want, like oil. These were usually the lower, what we call lower income or developing countries. And then I would arrange a loan for that country from the World Bank for a lot of money. But the money wouldn't actually go to the country. Instead, it would be transferred from a bank in probably in Washington, D.C. or New York, to a big construction company's bank like Halliburton or Bechtel or Brown & Root or Stone & Webster. You probably know the names.
Yes, sir.
And companies then would make a lot of money building big infrastructure projects in the country I had identified. Things like electric power systems, industrial parks, highways, ports, airports. Things that we could show would help grow the economy. You measure the economy by GDP. And so originally when I took on this job, I thought, you know, like I'm doing something really good here. I'm helping, helping these countries become more prosperous. But over time, I began to realize that really what we were doing was making the rich of those countries richer and more powerful and helping our own corporations to make a lot of money. Because in the people that benefited were the rich who owned the big industries and the commercial establishments. The businesses that benefited tremendously from better infrastructure. And yet the majority of the people in the country who weren't involved in these kinds of activities ended up suffering because money was diverted from healthcare, education, and other social services to pay the interest on the debt. But that's not obvious.
Yeah.
When you show the statistics of gross domestic product, GDP growth, It looks like everybody's benefiting. The fact is GDP is an extremely biased statistic, biased toward the rich yes. and powerful. And, you know, the other side of this coin was that if the president of the country or the minister of finance or whoever I was dealing with didn't accept these loans, they were very aware that there were people in the background we called jackals, who were usually CIA assets, who were prepared to overthrow a government or assassinate someone. And, you know, unfortunately, the United States has a long history of this with Allende in Chile and Arbenz in Guatemala and Mossadegh in Iran and Lumumba in the Congo and Diem and in Vietnam and most recently Zelaya in Honduras in 2009, where we've actually instituted these practices of overthrowing or assassinating leaders. And so these presidents know this, you know. So basically what I'm saying is, hey, here in this hand, I got a whole lot of money that's mm-hmm. going to help you and your family and your friends. But if you choose not to take this money in this hand, I got a gun. Jesus. Yeah, I never actually carried a gun, but these presidents knew what I was talking about, that there were people behind me that did carry guns.
Yeah. When I was reading it, the so what, like if I had to really compress what I experienced after finishing the book, it was very simply, it was your job was to get other countries, other businesses, individuals in debt up to their eyeballs as much as possible to basically force feed a dollar network effect around the world. Would you say that that's properly characterized based on?
Yeah, it's what's called the debt trap. And it's, you know, it's the new, most convenient and successful form of imperialism, building an empire. And this empire is really a corporate empire more than an American empire. Because let's face it, Preston, many of these corporations, when they prosper, they don't help the United States. They don't help the citizens here. They don't pay taxes. They may be listed as U.S. corporations, but as we all know, a very large percentage of the most profitable Fortune 500 corporations don't pay taxes. And yeah, I did also want to mention that, you know, so when these countries couldn't pay the principal on the debt, then I go back in using the guise of the International Monetary Fund and say, hey, we can help you refinance your loan. But to do that, you've got to meet certain conditionalities. Yeah. You've got to sell your oil or whatever the resource was. And today it's likely to be lithium or cobalt or some of the minerals that are used in the high-tech industry. You've got to sell these to our corporations at cut-rate prices without environmental or social regulations, or vote with us on the next vote against Cuba at the United Nations, for example, or let us build a military base on your soil, or privatize all your public sector businesses, your water and sewage systems, and so forth, and sell them to our investors at low prices, or maybe all of those things. And so, yes, we were really building this corporate empire, and at the same time, an economic system that's really failing us, what we could call a death economy that's causing climate change, that's causing yeah. income inequality, that's causing a lot of unrest around the world.
John, I have a question on that. So the economic imperialism thing, like, rung so true of what you were constructing. My question is, at the beginning, when you're constructing these loans, would you have already modeled out the additional loans based on the country defaulting that were going to be taken, and then the courses of action that you were going to take from an economic imperialism standpoint of the military base or the taking some of the production of the assets from that country? Was this already kind of pre-planned 4, 5, 6 steps out?
Yeah, you know, it's a strategy. So it's defined as, in the case of the minerals, that they're the collateral. So you give the mm-hmm. loan to a country like, let's say, Ecuador. It's got a lot of oil out in their very fragile Amazon area. And you give them a big loan and you use their oil that's still in the ground as collateral. So when they can't pay their debt, you go back in and say, now, okay, so now you can let our oil companies come in and take that oil at very cheap prices without any regulations. And when you're going forward with doing this, you're pretty aware that the country is not going to be able to pay back these debts. But they are going to be able to show this economic growth.
Yeah.
So the president is in an interesting position because he's being handed this report that we've done that shows that if he takes on these loans, the economy will grow, and it probably will. And he can take that to the local press and to his people, and it can be a very popular thing. Oh, my goodness, you know, this president's done great things. He's building all these highways. Look at how the roads have improved. I was just in Ecuador, which is one of the countries where I did this, and I just saw, you know, incredible road construction. And now most of the Chinese are playing the same game as we are. So they're doing the same thing. They're building, you know, hydroelectric plants and mines and so forth. And this can look very, very good on paper to the people. And let's face it, you know, presidents, even under the best conditions, don't serve for more than, usually more than 8 years, possibly 10 in most countries. And often it's a lot fewer than that.
And then on that point, so the economic growth, I think you hit on the electrical systems in your first book, and then you hit on the Chinese construction of like dams and roads in the third book, and this economic imperialism. Can you walk us through, when you're putting together these models, how much of the debt, so let's say I take out $10 in debt, how much of that debt would you expect to come back to Western countries, like through programs with Halliburton and Bechtel, versus how much money staying in that country?
The money itself, all of it, plus interest, and plus more, comes back because the construction company, you mentioned Halliburton, let's say, is making big profits off this, which theoretically some of it comes back to the United States, although Halliburton now is, I think, officially their headquarters is in Dubai, but notwithstanding that. And the banks are very insistent that these loans ultimately get repaid in one way or another. And at the same time, the oil is now being siphoned off, or whatever the resource is, out of the country to the U.S. or international, let's call them international oil companies. So they're not making money off that either very much. So the whole system is very, very rigged. What the country does show is that it's experienced economic growth as a result. But again, most of that economic growth benefits the very wealthy and powerful in those countries. And in so many of these countries, in Africa and in Latin America and elsewhere, you know, very few families essentially control the economies of these countries. And these families go back to very long time ago, to colonial periods. In Latin America, for example, most of these countries have families who were given these incredible land grants that their ancestors, who were generals under the Spanish conquistadors, under Cortez or Pizarro or one of the other conquistadors, who gave them huge amounts of land. And their families still have tremendous power within these countries. So they benefit significantly.
John, one of the things that I think is lost on a lot of listeners of our community is just how this relationship with the IMF and the World Bank works in harmony with this U.S. agenda to push dollar dominance around the world through this indebtedness. So if you were going to explain that relationship very simply for people to kind of be able to wrap their head around it, because I think people are familiar with the word IMF or World Bank, and they know that they're out there, but they just don't understand how they fit into the bigger picture.
Well, those organizations are all part of what we call the Washington Consensus. Just to make it even a little bit more complicated. So it's the World Bank, then there's the sister organizations, the Inter-American Development Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the U.S. Treasury Department. But basically, this would be a scenario. So USAID, United States Agency for International Development, sets aside a small amount of money. In my day, it would have been several hundred thousand dollars. Now it's probably a couple of million. It's a grant to a country. Let's stick with this case of Ecuador, since we started there. But it could be so many different countries. And this grant is used to hire my company, a consulting firm, to go in and do a study and say the World Bank is interested in giving a huge amount of money to this country, Ecuador. My job is to go in and make a study of where that money should be spent. Should it go into developing the electrical system, building hydroelectric facilities and transmission lines, or maybe it should go into highways or ports or airports? I produce a study that says the best investment would be a huge hydroelectric plant and all the transmission lines that go along with it, as an example.
And that so would be in that. And I'm sorry to interrupt you. So in that scenario, let's say that what they were ultimately after was oil or some type of like natural resource. Right. And you're looking at the setup inside this country. And let's say they don't have a lot of power. So step one is we've got to get power into the country so that then they can extract this raw commodity that we're actually interested in year 10 from now, or year 15 or 20 or whatever. So I'm assuming that there was like a much bigger, grander strategy with respect to the timing of like how you guys did this. Were you part of that, orchestrating that, or were you a little bit more granular in just the power, like you would have been told, let's go after power inside this country?
I would know. I would know. If I'm any good at my job, I know that, yes, part of it is exactly what you're suggesting. And so chances are this hydroelectric plant that we're going back to the World Bank to say, give this country a large amount of money to hire our companies to build a hydroelectric plant. Chances are the hydroelectric plant is out in the Amazonian area where the waterfalls and where the rivers, what's called the headwaters of the Amazon, the sacred headwaters area. And that's where the oil happens to be. Mm. So when you build a hydroelectric plant, you're also building big roads. Yeah. To get construction machinery in there, which is going to be a big benefit to the oil companies also. So yeah, there is that sort of thing that often goes on, not always. Anyway, so I go back to the country with this study, and I say, so here, you know, with this study, the World Bank is willing to give you this very large loan, but you have to sign off on and use oil as your collateral. And so the president says, well, let me take this to the people, mm-hmm. and gives his report to the local newspapers and says, you know, this is what I want to do. And maybe he's even going to have a referendum. And the people are going to say, yes, well, my God, this shows that our economy is going to grow at 8% a year. And it hasn't been growing at all in the last 2 years. We've got hyperinflation. We're going to get rid of that because the report would show that. And so then the money is diverted to a big construction company in the United States, let's say, and one of the big ones that we mentioned earlier, and they go down and build the project. And meanwhile, the country is paying the interest on the loan, and they're diverting money from social services or other programs to pay the interest. But in the end, they can't pay the principal. And so we go back and say, remember, the collateral is the loan, is the oil.
Yes.
So now we're going to start taking oil. Oh, and also, and now this is when we go in as the IMF, which is kind of the policing force behind the World Bank or the Inter-American Development Bank. And we go in as the IMF and we say, yeah, well, and you've got to meet some of these other conditionalities. Let us build a military base on your soil. And that's exactly what happened at one point in Ecuador, for example, built this huge military, U.S. military base on the coast of Ecuador, and on and on. So it's that kind of scenario. It starts with a grant. Mm-hmm. The country doesn't have to pay for it from the USAID. And then it moves into the loan, and then it moves into the conditionalities to restructure the loan.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
So one of the most common questions I get from family and friends is, Preston, where do you buy your Bitcoin from personally? And the answer is really simple. I buy it on river.com. Not only can you easily buy Bitcoin with zero fees on recurring orders, you can have peace of mind knowing Bitcoin on River is held one-to-one in multi-sig cold storage, all while being fully licensed and regulated in the U.S., plus, their relationship managers are U.S.-based and available by phone for you or your business. Additionally, River has built their own infrastructure from the ground up, which means they don't rely on third parties to function like the other Bitcoin exchanges. River also created a new feature not found anywhere else called River Link. It allows you to send Bitcoin over a text message to easily orange pill your family, pay a friend for dinner, or send a gift. There's absolutely a new standard in Bitcoin, and River is setting it. So go to river.com/fundamentals and get up to $100 free when you sign up and buy Bitcoin. That's river.com/fundamentals.
If you're a solopreneur, small business owner, or remote worker, then listen up because you've got to hear about Industrious. As a remote worker myself, I'm telling you that Industrious delivers the best co-working space I have ever been to. Industrious has co-working locations in major cities across the US, UK, Europe, Asia, and Australia, and they provide a ton of benefits to their members. They have secure high-speed internet, daily breakfasts and snacks, courteous on-site staff support, and my favorite part is the social events they host, which make it easy for me to connect with others who want to unplug from their work for a bit. I just recently visited their Kansas City office, and the people there were absolutely amazing, and the staff was incredibly helpful to help me get settled in and perform at my best. We Study Billionaires loves Industrious, and they were able to hook our listeners up with a free week of co-working to check it out, take a tour, and experience all of the amazing perks they have to offer. Visit industriousoffice.com, click join now, and use code WSB to redeem a free week of co-working when you take a tour. That's industriousoffice.com, click join now, and use code WSB to get your first week entirely for free. Today's episode is sponsored by Range Rover Sport. Range Rover Sport leads by example with their dynamic design that rises to the occasion. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capabilities, coupled with signature Range Rover refinement. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, redefining sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, offering next-level comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit-light driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can enjoy a dynamic drive and total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated, and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com.
All right, back to the show.
Can you walk us through, I think it was in the books, of how the IMF kind of works as this backstop? So I'd love to get like the listeners just to understand that if Western lenders beyond the World Bank are applying these loans or giving these loans to developing countries, and they're concerned about the creditworthiness, like this was, it seemed like a machine that you had created or that you were a part of and that you could replicate time and time again. But it seems like the IMF was that backstop that would come in, restructure those loans and make it sure that the Western lenders were always made whole on their loans. So then you could rinse, repeat over and over again and keep the country up to its eyeballs in debt.
Yeah, you've described it very well, Nico. I don't know. Is there a more specific question? You hit it right on the nail on the head.
I was more curious of like the lenders and the lenders and the IMF relationship, that they understand that the IMF is always going to step in or in this type of scenario, and kind of how was that working relationship? It's fascinating from your seat of you're actually on the ground and we're just observing this from really your words.
In these financial institutions, I know this is going to be the case. And before they make the loan, they'll probably check in with the IMF and make sure that the country that they're doing this with, I mean, they probably already know there's a list, but they want to make sure that where they're doing this is a country where the IMF will step in. And there may be some countries where that wouldn't happen and they wouldn't make the loan to those countries. So there is this, it's an old boy network. They all know each other very well and at the various levels of these organizations, and they communicate with each other frequently.
John, it seems like when I look at interest rates since the early 80s, they've just continued to go down up until COVID. And I think that continual step down in advanced economies of interest rates going lower and lower helped mask everything that was happening, because as they rolled the debt, they were able to roll it at a lower interest rate, which just seemed like we're kicking this principle further and further. If you can't repay it, well, then we'll negotiate the commodities or the military base or whatever. But I think it was almost like a tailwind for them to have these interest rates going lower and lower. I'm curious if you agree with that. And more importantly, for where we're at right now, moving forward, it almost seems like they're not going to be able to get inflation under control in advanced economies right now. And does this cause this entire economic hitman model to really start to blow up in the face of these advanced economies?
There's a couple of questions there. I think the answer to the first one is, yeah, the lower interest rates did help, I think, because suddenly the banks are in a position, or the economic hitmen are in a position to go to countries and say, hey, look, the interest rate's pretty low. You can afford this loan. Now, maybe you couldn't afford it before in the higher interest, but now with the lower interest rates, this is the time for you to do this. And in fact, you can take out a bigger loan. You can make an analogy with a home buyer in the United States. So, you know, the interest rates go down, the banks will tell them, well, you know, instead of a $300,000 home, you can afford a $400,000 loan because the interest rates are lower. When the interest rates go up, you got to go back to a less expensive home. Same sort of thing. And as far as The next question was, as interest rates are increasing, do I see the system blowing up?
Yeah. Does this model really start to get hard for them to control? And like we're seeing El Salvador right now, basically Bukele giving the middle finger to the IMF and World Bank and adopted Bitcoin as a new legal tender inside of the country. Like, I think that there's countries that are starting to figure this out in a very meaningful way. And I'm just kind of curious if you would agree that it's starting to unravel itself at this point.
Well, I think the biggest unraveling force for the Washington consensus is China, because China steps in and may offer lower interest rates or better deals in other respects. Actually, we can go to Ecuador as an example. When Rafael Correa was elected president, I know Correa very well. I was just recently in Mexico City on a TV program where he interviewed me. He likes my books. He has a PhD in economics from the University of Illinois, incidentally. He knows our system extremely well. He was president of Ecuador for 10 years. And one of the first things he did was to appoint a commission to look into whether Ecuadorian people really owed the money that the World Bank and IMF said Ecuador owed. And the commission concluded that I think it was about $10 billion. I may have the number wrong, but there was a lot of money that they said, no, the Ecuadorian people don't owe this. This money was taken out as a loan by the military dictatorships back in the 70s without the consent of the people. The people didn't get any benefits. Mm-hmm. These military dictators now are long gone. They're living in Switzerland or Miami or someplace. And maybe they owe the money. And Correa laughingly said, maybe John Perkins owes the money. He was one of those economic hitmen that was here back then. But the Ecuadorian people don't owe it. And he refused to pay a fairly significant amount of that in the billions of dollars. And thereby, the Standard & Poor's and Fitch ratings threw Ecuador into the dump. They basically said Ecuador is a worthless country. Nobody should invest or go to Ecuador to do anything. And immediately the Chinese stepped in and they gave Ecuador a big loan, very low interest rates that made it easy for Ecuador to pay off the interest. And the credit ratings went up. And then China made another loan. And as a result, Correa, who again has a PhD from a U.S. university in economics, threw the United States out, basically. And he closed out. He did not renew the lease on this huge military base. And the United States had to move its military base from Ecuador to Colombia. He went up against the United States and embraced China. And so now Ecuador owes a lot of money to China. And China's gone in and built the huge dam. They're building big mines. They're doing the same thing that we were doing, except they've offered some better conditions to Ecuador, at least the conditions that appear to be better. Not always what they appear to be. And I will say one other thing here, that China has an incredible marketing tool. And that is that they had about 10% economic growth for 30 years. They brought about 800 million people out of poverty. They increased the middle class tremendously. At the same time, since the early 70s, the United States has not had any real increase in average minimum wage, if you take account into inflation since the 70s. We've gone from 60% middle class down to 50%. If you're the president of a poor country and you're looking for an economic model, you're probably very, very tempted to look at the Chinese model. Not necessarily the political system, but their economic model is a very impressive one.
John, on that, do you see China running the same playbook as the United States and other Western developed economies have run to date that have the backing of the World Bank and the IMF? Or do you see China in this type of scenario running kind of an economic proxy war against the United States?
It's both, Nico. You know, I was asked to teach at an MBA program in Shanghai, which is mainly Chinese students who had been singled out to be the future leaders of the economy of China. And very quickly, I learned that the reason I'd been invited was because these students wanted to pick my brain as to what I had done that was successful, why I was successful, and what I'd done that were failures. And they've done an amazing job. They've been much more efficient in some respects. They really have learned from our mistakes and our successes. And I talk in this latest book about the four pillars of the economic hitman strategy. And one of those is fear. you know, fear, we talk about fear of Russia or fear of China or whatever, and they talk about fear of us or fear of your neighbors. And another one is debt, which we've been discussing. And the third one is anxiety over insufficiency. Oh, you're a really, really poor country, and we're going to help you relieve that anxiety. We're going to help you rise out of poverty. And the last one is divide and conquer. And China's made alterations in the way all of those are approached. But especially, they've made a huge alteration in the last one, divide and conquer. So, for example, when the United States would go into a country like, let's move from Ecuador to Peru, like Peru, and for no particular reason, but just because, yeah. Anyway, so, and they would say to Peru, hey, you know, let's, we'll do this deal and we'll give you most favored nation in our trading agreement. So bilateral trade between Peru and the United States will be really good. China, on the other hand, goes in and says, we're not interested in bilateral trade. We're interested in connecting you with the world, the new Silk Road, the Belt and Road Initiative. And so Peru, we're gonna build you these power plants. We're going to do basically the same thing the United States would do, but we're also going to build you a big port. So you're going to be connected with Africa and Asia and Europe. And it's not just about China and Peru. It's about we're going to help Peru become a world integrated with the world on a commercial basis. And that's huge. Countries really like that. Oh, and incidentally, we're not going to ever try to influence your policies, your government policies. We're not going to build a military base. And China hasn't built military bases in very many places other than in its own sphere of influence, with a couple of exceptions like Djibouti, where it refuels its ships that go around the African Horn and so forth. But it doesn't have a military presence. And they say, we're not going to build a military base here. We're not going to ask you to privatize your industries and sell them to our people. We're not going to ask you to vote with us in the United Nations votes, which isn't entirely true because they do expect these countries to side with them on the Taiwan issue. But they seem less draconian. And let's face it, there's a tremendous amount of resentment against the United States and our European allies and the World Bank because of the way we've imposed our will on countries. And, you know, we've been willing to overthrow democratically elected presidents like Allende and Arbenz. And we've backed terrible dictatorships like Pinochet in Chile and many others.
One of the stories that really stuck out to me in the book, it was somewhat early on. You were talking about, you were just implementing a lot of these field reports and coming up with the various models. And there was a person that I forget which country it was, but there was a person who was working on a report that was estimating that the growth would be like 10%. And your boss was like, that's not enough. Like, it needs to be juicier than that. And you were like, oh, well, I could come up with a model that does 20% or basically double what the other person was doing. And the other person was very hesitant to adjust their model. And because you were able to not only expand it, but do it in a way that was really backed up with what appeared to be a lot of evidence, like you were promoted immediately. And this behavior of trying to get the country in as much debt as possible by sensationalizing a lot of the reporting and the numbers was just somewhat mind-blowing to me, that this was the incentive structure that you were dealing with. Can you talk about just some of the mechanics of this and how other people that were doing similar jobs as yourself really kind of talk to the incentive structure that was behind all of this?
Yes, that's a really good point, Preston. You're talking about my relationship with a guy named Howard Parker, who he was very old school. And we're looking at electrical growth. And, you know, if you could show that the economy was going to grow by, let's say, 12%, if the electrical growth went up by 9 or 10%, and Howard would say, well, and he'd worked for the utility industry all of his life, retired as very high up executive of a major U.S. utility company, and then gone to work for our consulting firm. He'd say, well, the United States has never been electrical growth of more than 6% a year anyway. And I would say, yes, but if you've got to suppress demand. In other words, if you build these facilities and you have the electricity available, people will buy it. They just can't get it now. That's why the growth is so low. And so I believe that what I was saying was correct. And my boss very hardly was pushing me to make these much higher forecasts than Howard would make. And I thought it was correct. And I think, and I also, I'd come out of the Peace Corps, and I was steeped in this idea that we could really help poor countries rise out of poverty. And, I'd been to business school where I saw these econometric models that show this relationship between infrastructure growth and GDP growth. And I thought GDP growth was a good measure at that time. It took me quite a long time to realize that GDP growth is basically a tool of the rich. It's a poor statistic if you want to measure true prosperity.
Yes. We have a friend, Alan Farrington, and this is like one of his favorite talking points is bashing how terrible GDP is. It's like listening to him go down that path is amazing. But sorry, well, keep going, sir.
I'll leave it at that. But yes, it's a lie as far as measuring overall prosperity is concerned. And, I think there's a tremendous number of people in this industry today working for the World Bank or whoever that really believe they're doing the right thing. And at the top, they got to know the truth behind it. Mm-hmm. I believed for a long time that I was doing the right thing. And I have to tell you that once I started to understand I wasn't, and this I was helped in this very much by the head of state of Panama, Omar Torrijos, who understood the system and told me, John, don't you understand that what you're lying to yourself and you're selling all the rest of us a lie? But once I really understood that, I didn't want to believe it.
Yeah.
Because I was making a lot of money.
Yeah.
I came from, relatively poor teachers. I was a poor teacher's son in New Hampshire. We weren't starving or impoverished, but I'd never left New England until I joined the Peace Corps. And now I'm traveling first class all over the world, wining and dining in the best restaurants, staying in the finest hotels, and, hanging out with presidents. It's like, I didn't want to give that up. So once I began to understand the fallacy of the system, I didn't want to understand it. I wanted to fall for the line that everybody was out there promoting. And I think there's an awful lot of people in that situation today. We all lie to ourselves at one level or another. But,
yes.
My car, I don't drive that much.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/WSB. That's fundrise.com/WSB. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement. As someone who's constantly on the road and traveling, Briggs & Riley has been a game changer that ensures my travel experience is phenomenal. I'm a satisfied customer of Briggs & Riley myself, and I can certainly tell you that their luggage performs. It's extremely durable, it has amazing features that make packing and getting around easier, and they have the best lifetime guarantee in the industry. If your bag is ever broken or damaged, they'll repair it free of charge, no questions asked, even if your airline damages the bag. They also just released their Simpatico collection of hard-sided luggage. It has this new one-touch feature which allows you to expand your luggage, pack it, then compress it to its original size so a carry-on can still fit in the overhead compartment, plus many other cool features. If you want luggage that was awarded the best carry-on by Forbes, then now's the time to get it. Get your new and improved luggage at Briggs-Riley.com. That's Briggs-Riley.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
All right, back to the show.
No, I think it just speaks so much to your character to be able to hear the other side of the argument. And then, and you talk about this so well in the book, I love the way that you show this struggle as you're discovering this and you're having these conversations with other people when you are trying to understand the other side of the impact of what's happening. And I just find it so profound to speak to your character, to then have the courage to write and explain your point of view to the world, whether people want to side with you or not. I just think it's so profound, and I think it's just so courageous of you. And I think Nico's got the next question. So go ahead, Nico.
John, I had a real big question on this, and I feel like it was, I think there's a seminal moment in U.S. economic imperialism that you hit on in all the books. And this is the deal with Saudi Arabia and the transition to a petrodollar and Saudi buying U.S. treasuries. I would love if you can just simply walk through for all of the listeners that deal and the petrodollar post that.
Yeah, that was quite, yeah. So the context is the early 70s when so OPEC, which was led by Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia was the biggest oil producer in the world, had a lot of clout and did not like what was going on with Israel and our support of Israel and Israel defeating their world in many respects. And so there was an oil embargo imposed against the United States. And you guys are probably too young to remember it in person, but I do very well. And, you know, long lines at the gas stations, and our economy was in a nosedive. And it looked very, very serious. Without oil, what are we going to do? And we were very, very dependent on imported oil. So the Treasury Department comes to me and others at my company, and they said, you know, we can't let this happen again. Do something. I go off to Saudi Arabia with several of my assistants, people who work for me, and set up an office there. And the State Department, I mean, the Treasury Department signed a very large contract with my company to develop the electrical system in that country also. But we had to work out a deal with the Saudis on this whole thing. And this wasn't about debt, because Saudi Arabia didn't need to borrow money from anybody. They had the money. We wanted their money. And we also wanted to have them beholden to us, so they couldn't blackmail us again like they had basically with the oil embargo. So we worked out this deal basically whereby, as you said, Saudi Arabia would have to reinvest most of their petrodollars in U.S. treasuries. And the interest from those treasuries bonds would be used to pay U.S. corporations to essentially westernize Saudi Arabia, to build big cities that were Western type of cities, to build petrochemical plants and other industries in Saudi Arabia. And at the same time, part of the deal was that Saudi Arabia would never sell oil for anything other than dollars. So as you also mentioned, Nixon had just taken us off the gold standard in 1971, I think. And the dollar was floating out there. It was rather nerve-wracking time. And so now it's suddenly on the gold standard. It truly is a petrodollar. And so the agreement was that Saudi Arabia wouldn't sell oil for anything other than dollars. And also, they would never charge more for oil than the oil companies would ultimately be in agreement with. And our part of the deal was that we would protect Saudi Arabia. As long as they kept their part of the deal, we would always stand behind them, as we did during the Gulf Wars, Gulf Wars under both Presidents Bush, and as we did after 9/11 when we, you know, hustled some of their family members out of the country, and on and on. And this deal has been extremely significant. We called it the Saudi Arabia money laundering affair, Sammy, because it kind of was a money laundering affair, an oil laundering affair. You know, it's beginning to fall apart now.
Yeah.
And partly because China is now, you know, becoming such a strong entity, and Saudi Arabia does not want to lose that customer and that ally. And so they're wavering a little bit. And the other thing is that the Arab world has been very unhappy with the way we've treated Muslims and our stance in Israel. Mm-hmm. And despite Saudi Arabia's fairly good relationship with Israel, despite all these other things, what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, you know, it's been a thorn in the side of the Islamic world. And so there's a lot of factors here at play. We in the United States hear about how poorly China treats its Uyghur people, the other Muslim groups. But in the Muslim world, yeah, they're concerned about that, of course. But they also know that China hasn't sent armies into any Muslim countries, as we have in Afghanistan and Iraq and as would in elsewhere. So this old deal that's lasted since the early 70s until now, and it's still in effect, it's losing some of its teeth.
You know what I find really fascinating right now, John, is if you would take all the countries in the world and list the net producers on one side and the net consumers on the other side, what you'll find is all the net producers are the enemies or have been in the media, the enemies of the United States. I just find that really quite fascinating. And like when we look at, well, like why is the U.S. at odds with anybody that has excess production out of their country? And I think it kind of holds a key to understanding what's playing out right now with the breakdown of the petrodollar system. And I think that also when we're looking at interest rates and how they were literally compressed, I think we got to, what was it, Nika, maybe 18 trillion of negative yielding debt in the world of all these advanced economies. It was somewhere in that ballpark. So we basically compressed the yields to nothing. The prices were sky high on all debt leading up to COVID in 2020. And now it seems like all of this mathematically is starting to unravel itself with the Treasury and the Saudis pricing everything in dollars. It seems like this entire agreement is falling apart. And it's like, well, where does this go next? I'm curious if you have any just thoughts on this idea of the net producers versus the net consumers at odds with each other in the world and maybe what the root cause of a lot of this is.
I was one of the co-authors of a book called The Game as Old as Empire, and that's what this is, really. You know, it's building empires. And one of the biggest net producers, I think you'd say, is China. And of course, China definitely is threatening U.S. hegemony. Is China an enemy? I would really like to think of China as a competitor, but not an enemy. And, you know, we're all suffering from climate change. we can't afford to have enemies. Let's face it. Wars are part of the destruction of the environment and part of our problem today. We don't need to define China as an enemy. It is a competitor. But competition can be good if it drives you to be better. Mm-hmm. And I would like to think that we look at it that way, but we don't. We now, anybody that comes along that seems to possibly be better than us at doing anything, we object to. Back in the 70s, we went through something a little bit similar with Japan, where Japan was threatening us as, you know, they're so efficient and they work so hard and they put in so many hours and they were moving out of a period where we said they produced junk products into one where they produced quality products. They were leaders in quality. That was concerning to us, but Japan was a fairly small country. It didn't have much of a military or no military. It wasn't a real threat. China now, they come along and it's got this amazing economy. And it's also militarily very, very imposing and impressive. And there's no question, I think, that China wants to take over. They would like to replace the dollar with the UN or something. They don't want to do it too quickly because we owe them a lot of money, so they don't want to see the dollar collapse.
Yeah,
because that'd be very harmful to them. Plus, there's such an interrelationship between China and the United States and Europe, our NATO allies, the European Union, in terms of trade, in terms of finance, in terms of so many things, that China's being has to be relatively careful. And yet, clearly, they want to be the main superpower, and they're headed in that direction. And so the United States is strongly opposing it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's probably a smart move on the part of them. But I think the idea of demonizing them or seeing them as an enemy in some sort of a war, or defining it as even defining it as an economic war, to me is a big mistake. It isn't. Yeah. It's strong competition. We are extremely competitive with China. They're competitive with us. That can be a good thing, though. Competition. You know, I like to think of when I was in school, I was a pretty good tennis player, and I was always vying for the number one spot on our team. I was usually number two, but I was trying to take over number one. And number one and number two, the way you took it over is to beat number one. And yeah. So we play these hard games. We were and I think every time we played each other, we improved. But we, you know, but we were highly competitive. And then we came together as a doubles team in big matches with other schools. We were the number one doubles team. Mm. And so now the skills that we've developed competing with each other are serving us as a team.
Yes.
And I think that's a great example of how competition can make you stronger. And we all need to unify now to create the, you know, to transform this death economy, this economic system that's polluting and consuming itself towards self-destruction into a life economy that pays people to clean up pollution and develop new technologies that don't ravage the earth.
John, I have a question on that. I'm curious, a two-part question. One is, if the ability for the U.S. to continually print more money enabled really this entire economic hitman, economic imperialism model over the past 50 years. And then second part of that, as you talk about bringing the world together, does something like Bitcoin that is unable to be controlled by any country, can't be printed, there's no more that can be created, do you think that that takes away the teeth of all of this economic imperialism?
I think that possibility is there. However, if you look historically at the powerful empires, they usually are able to overcome those kinds of obstacles. And we know that China now is implementing its own sort of form of cryptocurrency. So I suspect that maybe what will happen is that the smart, you know, countries like China, maybe the United States will somehow co-opt the crypto movement. I don't know. I mean, I think that we are going to move away from the central banking system, because it's just plain not working well. And basically everybody knows that, whether they want to admit it or not is another question. And cryptocurrency is here. And we all use it, you know, to a certain degree. Like, even if you've never bought anything, you use a credit card. You know, we're all dealing in digitized forms of currency on a big scale. A lot of places don't take money anymore. You know, so many places where I shop, you can't buy anything with currency. Cash, you got to use credit, including on the airlines. We're definitely moving in that direction. How that plays out, though, remains to be seen. And it's hard to believe that the big, powerful economies like China and the United States and the European Union won't somehow worm their way into having control over these systems.
It almost seems like co-opting is the specialty of a lot of the government models over the, like, just co-opt everything with enough time and duration. John, I know you got to go real soon here. If there's one thing that you want to leave our audience with, maybe a very short, compressed, like, so what of the book and what you were trying to accomplish with this, what would that message be for the audience?
Well, I think the message is one of, well, I not think, I know the message is one of hope, that we are in a time of extreme crisis and challenge. And also incredible opportunity.
Yes.
You know, as I travel around the world speaking at various events, or as I do lots of podcasts in many countries, I'm just about to do one after this with a podcast in South Africa. And people around the world there's a consciousness revolution.
Yes.
People are really understanding that we cannot continue with this economic system we have, which we call a death economy, that we have to move into a system where we pay people to mine the plastic in the oceans, you know, and recycle it, to plant trees and to reforest areas and to fill in old mine pits and to create new technologies for energy and other things that we haven't even dreamed of yet.
Yeah.
You know, solar and wind have been improving rapidly, but they're still in their infancy. So we've got this incredible opportunity. So I'd like to leave people with the idea that we should all feel very blessed to be alive at this time when we're facing big crises, but we have incredible opportunities to move the human experience to a new level of consciousness and action that takes us to a completely new understanding of what it means to be successful human beings, being human on this amazing planet where we live.
God, I love that. I love this book. I'm serious. Like, one of the top books I've read in the past 5 years. If you're listening to this and you have not read this book, you have got to go out and check this thing out. It is unreal. John, thank you for your time. We'll have links to that in the show notes. We'll have links to anything else that you want us to highlight there if people want to check it out. But thank you for your time, sir. This has just been such a pleasure.
My pleasure, indeed. Keep up your great work. And yeah, please connect to johnperkins.org.
Yes, sir.
And the new book is on there, too. Yeah.
Yes, sir. We'll have that.
My pleasure. Thank you guys so much. I've really enjoyed it. Keep up your great work.
Thank you, sir. Have a blessed
day. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
If you guys enjoyed this conversation, be sure to follow the show on whatever podcast application you use. Just search for We Study Billionaires. The Bitcoin-specific shows come out every Wednesday, and I'd love to have you as a regular listener. If you enjoyed the show or you learned something new or you found it valuable, if you can leave a review, we would really appreciate that. And it's something that helps others find the interview in the search algorithm. So anything you can do to help out with a review, we would just greatly appreciate. And with that, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you again next week.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to follow Bitcoin Fundamentals on your favorite podcast app and never miss out on episodes. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.